and I'm forcing stuff down people's throat. Well, if they ask the question, then I feel more more entitled to try to get my best answer in that particular area, what little I know with my particular experience. And as I said before, not everything you hear on the TechNet is going to be 100% accurate. We try to correct that from time to time. We think it's peer-reviewed, if you know what I mean. John, I know you wanted to tell us the price. So what's the price of this beautiful machine? KC2MMY. Here we go. KC2WGB. KQIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB.
Yes,
KD2, 8 vitamins information. That device is $549. That's not bad for something that works, but I don't know the size or what it looks like. You know, you have to go on them. That's pretty good if it works.
Okay, that's worth considering. I've got a guess as to Joe's finances right now, and I'm sure that's going to be a little bit pricey for him. You and I, with these big bucks sticking out of our pockets and dripping down the street as we walk along, we would go out and spend $500 without asking another question. That's a joke. Don't take me serious, you guys. Okay. You've got a challenge there, Joe. We're trying to help. Let me give you warning ahead of time. There's no simple solution for what you're trying to do, but there are ways of making it a bit easier. We've given you a few of those suggestions tonight. Please come back with future questions, and I know that this is a series of questions. I'm now recognizing that you've mentioned this antenna model to us before, and you got to keep remembering the fact that I'm a kind of forgetful. You mentioned something on 1 week, and you re-mentioned it 2 weeks later. You got to give me a few more hints as to what happened in the past. I am kind of forgetful from time to time. I think it's time to go over to the mailbag, John. KC2WGB. What kind of challenges have come through that particular portal tonight? KQIW, you got it, John.
Ray, I just want to let you know, I'm not complaining at all. I just wanted it to just a stimulation thing. No complaints here at all. Okay, KC2MMY.
K2J, yeah.
Dick, you want to check your list? I think we had somebody left out there. Just double check.
Yeah, Roger's bringing that to my attention right now. K2JAS. Somehow I forgot you, Roger. Roger, you got the floor. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, good evening, Dick.
May I say something?
My name is Roger, and I am an advanced class amateur for the last 45 years or so. And I've been around since 1950. I've been away from radio for quite some time, and I had a question that I wasn't able to find an answer to about amplifiers. Let me drop it 1 second.
You had questions.
My legal power was say an advanced class licensed amateur, and what I was able to come up with was 1500 watts PEP to the antenna, and to me that means output power. But I was always under the impression that the power is measured as input power, plate voltage times plate current, and depending on the efficiency of the amplifier, would give you something completely different on the output side, but usually much less than 100%, of course. So the question is, am I correct that the power should be measured on the input and not the output? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Don, good question, Roger. That's the way it used to be. For a whole lot of years, I'm not sure of the exact date. I'm going to pick a number of the year. Maybe it was around 1990 or so. When I cut my teeth on the ham radio in 1956, from 1956 to something like 1990, the FCC dictated that you measured input power, like you said, plate voltage and plate current, and that determined input power, and whatever you got out of that was up to you and the design. Because of the fact that the modern-day rigs that we all buy, I'm guessing now, modern rigs that we buy, you don't easily have access to the plate current, plate voltage of the final stage. Some yes, some no. But you have easy access to what's coming out of that rig by way of a Berg watt meter if you buy the fancy version that does peak envelope holding for single sideband, or you do a two-tone test or whatever. For the ease of measurement, they started measuring output, and also there was all kinds of complaints about, hey, we're not getting enough power to do moon bounce, and we're doing all this special temporary authority, making all of these requests for the special licensing from the FCC to run moon bounce. They finally settled it all, in my opinion. Let me drop it. Somewhere around 1990, and somebody will correct me on the exact date, they suddenly flipped over from input power to output power. So now we're days. The output power is measured as to what you're able to deliver to the antenna, per se. Assuming you've got a low-loss feed line. When it comes to key down Morse code, I think you're allowed to run 1,000 watts. When it comes to peak envelope power of normal single sideband, you're allowed 1,500 watts peak envelope power. And you got to be careful now how you rate the peak envelope power. You got to determine the time constant of that metering. If I actually look cycle by cycle at the nanosecond rate of the RF energy that's in that peak envelope power, I come up with a higher number. So they did come up with a partial definition of how it's measured, but it is now output power, has been for some time. Let me throw it open to the group, because some of you guys are better at remembering the history than I am. Does anybody know the approximate year in which the Federal Communications Commission flipped over from input power to output power rating of what hams with an advanced class license are allowed to, general and advanced and extra class license are allowed to run? If you happen to know that year, give me your call letters right now, K2IW the TechNet. And maybe it's only academic, and maybe we can Google it, and maybe we can Wikipedia it. So there was a trade-over, and so for a significant number of years of the modern era, we're allowed to measure output power, and it makes life a lot easier. And so you're worried about the legality, and I don't blame you, Roger. You're afraid that a 1,500-watt output transmitter may really have peak envelope power of 2,500 in, and isn't that violating the FCC's rules? By modern rules, I think the answer is no. K2JAS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the gang, K2JAS. Okay, actually, my thought was this. I have a Drake LV, which I have modified to run 3-5. As I recall, at one point in time, I was able to run the maximum amount of legal power that I could with that amplifier, and to me, somehow it said that 1,000 watts CW was the thing. And I was wondering if there are a hell of a lot of guys around there delivering more than 1,000 watts CW. Like perhaps, I don't know, maybe Al would know, the 50L something or other? There's a linear there, that or the Henry 2K. They could probably do more than 1,000 watts CW. Well, let me ask Al, what do you think? Al may have transitioned out. But if Hal is available, I quickly wanted to ask him if he knows what happened to Tracy. I think it's W202K. Hal, are you there?
Yeah, Hal may not be there, Roger. By the way, if the rig that you own, the transmitter that you own, puts out 1,000 watts, that's pretty darn good. And yes, if you owned a Henry 2K, or I'm trying to think of the model number of the rig that Rich N2EO used to own. There's a modern day afterburner amplifier that a lot of people own, which can run, I think it's called the Henry 2K, but can literally run 2,000 watts of output, and to be legal, you should be throttling it back a little bit, unless you're doing moon bounce. As I see it, it's a victimless crime. If you're aiming antenna at a high angle up in the air, you're aiming it at the moon, and you run these kinds of powers, with or without special temporary authority licensing from the FCC. It's a kind of victimless crime. And I don't think somebody's going to be pounding down your door because you've gone to 1,501 watts, if you know what I mean. There's ways that you can take your 1,000-watt amplifier, boost the voltage that's going into that final stage. If you're doing it brief enough and you make sure that you don't shout into the mic and hold a steady tone for a long period of time and overheat that final tube, as long as it's got enough air flowing through it. There's lots of ways that a tube amplifier that normally puts out ICAS readings of 1,000 watts, and you'd like it to put out 1,500 watts peak envelope power, to make that happen is not too difficult, Roger. Let me drop. But now you're going to have to weigh price to... price to earnings ratio is not the word. Price to grief ratio. When you go from 1,000 watts to 1,500 watts, you've made a 1.76 dB of increase. That is 30% of one S unit. Is that really going to allow you to get through on that pileup? You're talking to this rare DX station, and you've already got 300 countries, and you want 301. And is that last 1.76 dB going to do it? And are you willing to invest the amount of money and time? Now, that's for you to decide. So when a person looks at 500 watts of increase from 1,000 watts, it sounds like a big number. If I was running a 1-watt transmitter, QRP, and I increased it to 1.5 watts of output, it's the same percentage of increase. It's the same 1.6 dB of increase. And so a half a watt of increase, the average guy will say, ah, that's not worth fighting for. But 500 watts of increase, is that worth fighting for? You got to be careful about using the watts correctly, and you might want to convert it to dBs to find out what the other guy on the other end is really going to hear. KC2RJS, K2RIW. That's a bunch of opinions, Roger. K2RIW, listen to me.
I agree with you 100%. And no, I was not trying to run more power with this thing. I was just trying to find out if all of a sudden they increased the power so that now you're not running 1,000 watts, you're running 1,500 watts. But again, this business of input and output is a whole different ballgame. And I wasn't realizing that was what was happening. Let me just stop here for just a moment and tell you a very, very, very interesting story. Let me drop it. I still have a dear friend, I haven't spoken to him in many years, who was the engineer in charge of TV station called WHT, if anyone remembers, Wilmette Go Home Theater. And at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, when he ran the night shift, I would play games with him and ask him to cut the power down. And he went from 50,000 watts to 25,000 watts, and I didn't see any difference in my picture. In fact, he would probably have to bring it down to 5,000 watts before I saw any snow on the screen. And so we had a great deal of fun playing around with the power amplifier of this television station. He says, but the people in Philadelphia, let me drop it. Philadelphia might have dropped out a lot sooner, but I was about 40 miles away to the south. I'm in Marlboro, New Jersey. So that's that story, and I thank you gentlemen for the very, very interesting discussions tonight. Let me turn it right back to you, Dick. And did you know Tracy Dyer's, I think it was in the UK.
I'm not sure if I do remember him, but wow. So you talked to a guy with a 50,000 watt output broadcast transmitter to go down to 25,000 watts at 2 o'clock in the morning for the WHT function. And I think that WHT in the early days was transmitting adult material at certain hours of the night if you subscribe to their service. And I think there were quite a number of people out there making homebrew circuits and modifying things in order to get that material without necessarily paying for it. Was that Wilmette Home Theater, was that also a so-called wireless cable TV? Is that what I think they called it? Back to you, Roger, K2LAW.
K2J, yes, you nailed it. But I can't actually admit to having watched that material. But nevertheless, there was all kinds of bootleg boxes and circuits and whatever, and I would even bring my TV up to the station and tune the IFs or whatever so that we could get a better signal. We had a lot of fun back in those days. In fact, I was using a garbage can cover as a coffee can with a little vertical wire as the antenna. But good days, good memories, and I fully understand that if you're starting with a go down to 500, you haven't really done much. It's probably not even a 3 dB. Is there is that a 3 dB adjust noticeable difference?
What's the threshold of grief? Varies tremendously depending on what service you're talking about. For a guy who's doing moon bounce, where in the old days before WSJT, weak signal Joe Taylor, K1JT, before Joe Taylor did his thing with Reed Solomon back-end receiver processing techniques, where you get a 20-some-odd dB advantage, and now you can do moon bounce with a couple of Yagis and 100 watts on 432 megasecond. In the days when you needed 400 square foot of antenna area on transmit, 400 square foot antenna area on receive, and at least 1,000 watts getting to the antenna, if not more, and a 1 dB noise figure, in order to get a very weak CW signal bouncing off that moon with a 60% copy, if you know what I mean. In those days, a 1 dB change in the transmit effective radiated power, a 1 dB change in the receiver sensitivity, could definitely make the difference between a QSO or a non-QSO. And with modern day, let me drop. With our modern day digital techniques of television reception, if you had a way of adjusting the carrier to noise ratio is one test, or signal to interference ratio would be another test. You do those kind of tests on digital over the air television broadcasting that's being used today. You'll find out that you get a beautiful snow-free picture until you hit a particular threshold, and as you hit that threshold and the picture starts locking up and starts giving you artifacts, the difference between an acceptable picture and a picture that's really not there 90% of the time and not worth waiting for, if you know what I mean, that's approximately 1 decibel of difference. It's got a very sharp threshold. Another example of something that's got a very soft threshold is single sideband reception under normal ham radio purposes. And you've probably seen situations like that where you've established a QSO, the guy is running a 100-watt amplifier or a 500-watt amplifier, and you start asking him to go QRP, and he starts going weaker and weaker, and he gets down to the 1-watt level, and you're still talking to him. There are times when there's a huge number of dBs of difference depending on conditions. So you have to worry about what protocol, what method of modulation. You get a fairly sharp threshold of FM demodulation on a good amplifier discriminator, limiter discriminator on an FM receiver, depending on what is the modulation index. Is it narrowband FM or wideband FM? You get a very soft threshold in one versus the other. So what signal-to-noise ratio is required to get acceptable performance of your communication system, let me drop, is very dependent on what is the exact protocol, what is the mode of modulation. A completely snow-free television picture is something like 47 dB signal-to-noise ratio in the analog days. And when you get down to about a 30 decibel signal-to-noise ratio of television, it's a very snowy picture, and sometimes you start losing sync lock. So television requires very high signal-to-noise ratios, because you could say the eye is very critical for the snow on that screen, and you want the 47 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio in amplitude, in AM old-fashioned television, whereas we ham radio operators on sideband reception, if you've got a 10 dB carrier-to-noise ratio, you say that, that's wall-to-wall, and it really sounds beautiful, if you know what I mean. A 10 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio on a good FM system gives you 20 decibels of quieting. So, it varies. I think you're telling me, John, there was somebody else I forgot that should be on the list. Refresh my memory. KC2WGB, K2IW and Technet.
Comment about WHC. WS plan.
Okay, I'm going to come back to your comment in a second. John first. John, do you remember somebody? Do you remember somebody that I'm forgetting that should be on the list? Over to you, John.
Unfortunately, I don't have the call, but there was somebody in there. Maybe they're not there any longer, but we'll give it a break to see if he comes on. If not, pick a call. KC2WGB.
Oh, yeah, Freddy.
Oh, yes, it was a battery question. That's it.
Yeah, Freddy with the battery question. All right, we're going to pick up Freddy in a minute. We're going to first get the comment on the subject on the floor from Paul. WS2N, tell us about WHT. Did you own one of those demodulators? You got it, Paul.
Yes, I did. Probably a couple of years, and I still have the box, and it received on channel 68. And it was strange. The picture, of course, would come up on whatever TV you had, but the sound wouldn't come into your speakers wouldn't work inside your TV. The sound would come up only on, you know, through the box. They had a forward facing speaker, probably a 2.5-inch speaker, and that was it. So it was pretty incredible. We needed to have something like that here when I first moved in the 70s, or the, you know, WHT came out, I guess, in the 80s, earlier 80s. So you needed to have some kind of decent picture because the signals from the city were just terrible. I had a preamplifier on there. Yeah, once in a while they were okay, but, tough signals. I got Connecticut very good. And then, of course, once cable came through, we abandoned WHT. Back to you, Dick.
With that beautiful piece of land you've got, Paul, all you had to do is put up a tall enough tower with a good antenna on the top to do television DXing from New York City with a preamplifier up top. You could have done it. I didn't say it's easy. And on a good day from the top of my tower, there are times when I can watch UHF television from quite a number of the surrounding states, and that gives me a lot of things to watch. As such, in this so-called progressive community that I live in, Dix Hills, a section of Huntington, Long Island, about 40 miles east of New York City, there's 25 or 26,000 people in my community of Dix Hills. There's only one human being in those 26,000 that I know that is doing over-the-air television reception from New York City with digital TV. All the other television aerials on the roofs have been removed. One or two that remain, I can see that the transmission line has ripped away, and there's nothing connected to it. So there's only one guy out of 26,000 people in my community watching over the air television. Okay, Freddie, I know you've got a question about batteries.
I did have an antenna, a 180-mile antenna, supposedly on top of my chimney. Just a quick comment on that. I did have that with the preamplifier, and it was still bad. Nothing like today. Your digital TV is great. Small antenna, big difference.
Let me ask you this question, though, Paul. Your particular land, make a rough guess. How many feet above sea level is your particular piece of land, Paul?
I think I'm in the valley. You know, I have the numbers, but there's too much around me. I'm pretty low. That's the problem. But, I mean, I would need a 40-foot tower at least, I guess. That might be there.
The highest piece of land on Long Island is at James Hill, Huntington, roughly 395, 398 feet high. And so when I was buying the house that I'm now living in, my wife and I spent close to 2 years searching for the right house, telling every real estate dealer I want high land. And I managed to find something within my price range where the land was approximately 300 feet above sea level, because I knew I was going to be doing some serious VHF, UHF ham radio for the rest of my life. So I wanted to buy a chunk of high land on Long Island, and I sort of succeeded. And I'm awful glad I did. It made life a lot easier. Okay, for my kind of operation. Freddie, VBN, I think it is. I think it's W2VBN. Go right ahead with your battery question, Freddy. K2LIW in the TechNet. Freddy, are you there?
Do see you again.
I think I heard somebody named CUK. Are you hearing Freddie, or are you, you asking us a question? This is CUK, KQRIW, go ahead.
Hey, I have a question that's a real stumper for you.
Okay. And by the way, we were taking over your swap and shop tonight, as you heard earlier. Mr. CUK, who normally runs the swap and shop, go ahead, Bill, KQRIW.
Well, tonight's Sunday, so I don't think the swap and shop would be tomorrow anyway. I have a problem with a TV set. Actually, it's my tenant's TV set, a 27-inch RCA flat screen. I don't know if it's a plasma or an LED or LCD, but it puts out a signal that basically wipes out the 2-meter band, starting at about 142 megahertz all the way up to 147, probably beyond. And when she turns it off, I can talk to you, hear the repeater. But when she turns it on, I get a full-strength signal on the S-meter. But I can open the squelch and hear squelch. So that tells me, I think, that it's coming in on the IF. But what do you know about the electronics of these newer flat-screen television sets?
From what you're describing, Bill, I think that's an unusual case. There is now a flat-screen television set in my house, and I do ham radio at the same time that it's running, and it doesn't create that problem. I'm guessing some of the earlier, what do they call it now, plasma screen? There's a kind of plasma screen display, not liquid crystal, that I think could make radio broadband noise. That sounds to me like that particular set may have a defect, and it may be violating FCC rules of extraneous emission. You're thinking it's coming through your IF strip of your receiver. I doubt that, Bill. And if you wanted to, you could put a filter on your antenna to make sure nothing but the RF frequency you care about, 146 megacycles, is coming through. I think it's much more likely it is 146 megs that you're hearing from that TV set that should not be there. And how in the world did you narrow that down? How did you find out that the neighbor's set was doing it? Did you take your handy-talkie and walk around and find out where the strongest signal was coming from? That was a fancy kind of fox hunting you did there, Bill. WB2CUK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2CUK. Well, basically, I had a new tenant move into the upstairs part of my house, and I hadn't had any problems, but then I noticed this. And I asked her if she was using a microwave or anything, any kind of computer. She said no. I didn't ask her about a TV set, but, I'm listening, and I walked around the house with an HT. It has a few areas that were nulled out where the noise would null out. Then all of a sudden, I'm watching and I'm looking at the radio here, and all of a sudden the noise disappeared. So I yelled up to her. She turned anything off. She said, yeah, a TV. So I basically asked her to turn it off on the night of my swap and shop. Tonight for a couple of hours so I could get on the net. And, yeah, I guess you're probably right, because if it's coming in on an HD, who knows what the IF is. But it's strange. I get a full-scale S-meter reading, but if I can open the squelch and hear noise. So, I don't know. If I brought a some kind of a counter or a very sensitive, these meters they use for cable TV, if I brought one up with an antenna, you think that would, I could be able to pinpoint the exact frequency it's coming out at?
KC2QAQ with Kevin.
Go ahead, Glenn. I wonder if you've run them. Glenn, you got it, Glenn.
I've seen this problem a lot with not only television sets, but the bigger one is the computer monitors, the flat-screen computer monitors, and that noise is broadband noise coming from the power supply inside those flat-screen TV sets. They're switching power supplies, they're not properly filtered, and there's certain TV sets that are definitely big offenders, and definitely, I know like Acer monitors, some of them that you buy from directly from China, same problem. You turn them on, and where it was causing problems for me, living with a drop, I was mainly noticing the problem on a 2-meter sideband. I didn't get it on 70 centimeters or 1.2. Even on HF, I didn't see a problem. But boy, oh boy, what a pain in the neck it was trying to do sideband work. And I realized I had my computer on. So I had to go step by step, shutting off the computer, turning off the, and finally it was the monitor. And it would only come on when the monitor started drawing current. In other words, like if you got a burst out of the monitor, and I believe it's the same problem with the TV sets, and it's just because you start drawing more current out of the switching power supply. And I was able to cure it by taking a ferrite core and wrapping a lot of turns around the AC input cable and plugging it in also to a different circuit than the one where I had my 2 meter sideband set. But here again, it's more than likely it really is the power supply inside the flat screen TV. KC2QIQ.
Good information, Glenn, and I thank you. I think with some further testing, Bill, you're going to discover that the direct radiation from the screen itself probably is not it. The switching power supply that Glenn just brought to our attention is a very strong candidate for the bad guy. And how it's getting to you, quite possibly, right now I think there's a 90% chance it's getting to you by way of its power cord. Your tenant upstairs and you are sharing the exact same fuse panel, ultimately, if you know what I mean. The main power line coming into the house is being split to your power and your tenant's power. And so that's the common denominator. And so when it comes to a solution, it's not going to be easy, but putting a ferrite device, maybe a great big toroid with a power cord, is wrapped through it a number of times, putting a great big series inductor by way of that toroid on the power cord of her TV set is certainly worth a try. The chances of you talking her into stopping using that set and going out and buying another one, you and I know, is very slim. But when you've got the right kind of instrumentation and you hold the right kind of a sensitive receiver near that power cord, which is being shared throughout your house, the power line going into it, I think, is the common antenna, Bill. And so you might be able to stop it at the source. KC2, KB2Q, here we go. KB2CUK, WB2CUK, eventually get your teacher IW, you got it, Bill. KC2, the comments. Let's see if, Hal, well, what do you think is the solution on this one, Hal?
I do think it's definitely the power supply, because those switching supplies are square wave. Square wave is very rich in harmonics, and they tear up everything. Go ahead.
What do you recommend that he use as a solution? Assuming now that this is a $1,000 set, then he's not going to be able to talk his tenant into throwing away that set and buying a brand new one. By some means, we're going to have to live with this one. Have you known of people having success with that kind of noise by putting the right kind of a series inductor on the power lead, wrapping the power lead through a good-sized toroid, for instance? Over to you, Hal, K60BZ, K2RIW.
Okay, yes. Okay, stand by, JS. Yeah, the solution is he has to build a low-pass line filter, not just a toroid, but a physical filter with two chokes and two caps, a regular pie-type filter, and have a good ground on it. Chances are you can knock out the square wave harmonics all the way down. Go ahead.
Do you know of a commercial product that Bill can buy? Maybe it's a $10 item that has that filter built into it. Is there a place where he can go and buy that filter that you're describing? Over to you, Hal, K2LAW.
Well, the best place, Radio Shack has the chokes. They're inductive chokes, so they look like regular resistors, and a couple 001 caps, four 001 caps, two of those chokes, make a double L network, pi network, have the center tap grounded, put that in a little box, and he can build his own filter.
If he was building that filter for himself, I would be in 100% agreement with you, Hal. When you're doing it for somebody else's television set, if you're taking a commercially manufactured, industry-accepted, commercial product filter, model number so-and-so, made by the such-and-such company, you buy it and it's intended for that kind of service, great. For Bill to homebrew it and to talk somebody else to install that on their television set We're getting into a very sticky area of liability here, and also whether or not that person will accept it. I'm hoping that somebody makes that filter as a commercial product that he can go out and buy. If it takes $20 to buy the thing, I know darn well that Bill would do that immediately, and the problem goes away. To homebrew it for somebody else's set, I think we're in a sticky area here. K6DBZ, K2LIW.
Jim, go ahead, make a comment. No, I'd say you don't have to go in the TV set to do it. You build it a separate little LMB box, in and out, and that's it. You don't have to touch the set at all.
I know it was an external box. For him to take a homebrew circuit that he makes and tell his neighbor to plug that in for their set, there's many a neighbor will say, how do I know you're not going to damage my TV? Over to you, Casey. Mr. QIQ, you got it. K2LAW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Unfortunately, a lot of these EMI fixes with the cord, when they're commercially purchased, are expensive. That's the only downside. If you even do searches on eBay, you can find what are called filtered power cables, where most of the time what these are basically they mold the choke into the filter, into the power cord, and that they're usually only good for television sets that have the IEC 3-pin connector where you can unplug and plug in your own power cord. If it has that type, usually that's the solution, and that's usually the cheaper one. Let me let it drop. The second step is a loop. This one almost always works 100%, but the problem is the price tag on it is pricey. It's not like a $10 or $20 item like the line cord. This one is, they make power strips that are fully filtered. If you usually go to the high-end TV shops or places that will sell, you know, the home entertainment centers, look on the racks over there and you'll see these things. They're usually called pure signal filters. And they're basically just like they look like a line strip, and they're usually all multicolored. You'll see multicolored outlets on them, and I think they're basically filter sizes for different plugs, for different current ratings as you plug them in, and each one of those plugs on that strip has different levels of more attenuation, and a lot of times you plug it into one of those strips, and the worst offenders generally are fixed, but unfortunately those are usually over $100, Dick. That's the problem. Casey 2QIQ.
Even at $100, I would consider it. But my first response when it comes to somebody else's TV is to try to find a commercial product that does it. To build a homebrew circuit in a box, no matter how neat you make it, and to take somebody else's TV set and you tell them to plug that into your homebrew circuit, even though they may not say it to you, the first thing in the back of their mind is, how do I know you're not damaging my TV? With your own hokey gadget, if you know what I mean. Whereas if it's a type accepted, so to speak, if it's a commercially prevalent product that has a track record, you're a hell of a lot safer. So I would take that approach first, Bill. Try to find a filter that you can get her to plug it into that is not homebrew. That's just my opinion, and you've got lots of ways of going here. WB2CUK, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, Al, absorbing all of this information here, I had also thought of just grounding the TV to the power line, to the outlet. Just take a ground wire and grounding it while I brought an HT up there and listen to this stuff. But all these things, and I hadn't really thought about the power supply. When I come to think of it, I have a little switching supply here that when I used to power up shortwave radio, I could hear the harmonics in the shortwave set. So, yeah, that would be a very strong case there for the power supply being the issue. And I don't know of anything else in the TV set to generate that. I think the older sets use a 3 megahertz or 3.5 megahertz color crystal for the chroma section, but that's about it. So anyway, thanks for the information. I'm going to try the toroid thing. That sounds pretty good. I could probably get some of those big donut toroids and wrap the power cord around that as many times as I could and try that. And I'll be able to get up there. She'll let me up there into her kitchen, and at least I know where it's coming from, and it's not a mystery. Dick, thanks for the information, and give me some time here on the net, and I'll give it back to you and your rest of your questions here. K2RIW, WBGCUK. Give me clear. I'll be listening.
K2JIS for round.
I'm in, Dick.
Stand by, Roger. If I took your 80-meter dipole pole, assume you had one, assume it's being fed with a real good balance, and it's radiating from that dipole, and now I establish a real good ground wire from the input grounded lead of your hybrid, of your balancing device at the antenna, and I put a real good ground wire on it, would that stop your dipole from radiating? Absolutely not. When you get radiation on a power line, and the power line is the antenna, and now you just simply ground the TV set itself with another wire alongside of it, going to some real good ground, water pipe or whatever, the chances of that stopping the radiation of the signal being radiated by the power cord, I think, is very slim. You got to create some real good choking on all the wires of that power cord. The toroid can do it. This filter we've been discussing that you can find a place to buy it will do it. Try the grounding lead if you want to. I think the chances of success are fairly slim on that one. Roger, go ahead with your comment for Hal, if he's still there. K2JAS, K2LAW.
K2JAS, thank you, Dick. Hal, are you there?
K2JAS, K6DPZ, write this down, 516-678-3430. Give me a call right now, okay?
516-678-3430. Thank you. Calling now.
Guys, K6DPZ clear.
Okay, so now we're willing to go over to Freddie.
I have a comment first, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, what I think he should do first on this interference problem is disconnect the cable box, whatever's feeding that TV, because many times it's coming from the HDMI cable and things like that. Make sure, isolate the TV, see if he still gets the noise with just the TV running with nothing else. Then he can proceed to troubleshoot, because if they have an unshielded HDMI cable, I've seen that cause the problem too. So, you know, he's got to do it, break it down one step at a time. That's it. KC2WG, be back to you.
You may have hit on something there, John. I was just in Radio Shack tonight, or was it last night, and they sell all kinds of HDMI cables. And so I'm guessing the cheap one might not be shielded, and the more expensive one might be shielded. They got quite a few different prices for the HDMI cables. So is a higher quality HDMI cable, do they do a better job of shielding? But by way of a divide and conquer, what you're saying is that first turn off the F connector input to the television set, which is the cable TV real signal, disconnect it, see if the interference is still there, and if it goes away, then you know it's being radiated by the output shield of that cable, then by way of the HDMI cable. Now, most digital modern-day television sets are standalone, and the built-in receiving function and the display function are no longer a separate box connected by an HDMI cable. Oh, wait a minute now. That's a so-called cable rigging set. What you're saying is that the real demodulator for the cable company that he's using has a separate box that sits alongside of the set, and that output is an HDMI cable. And if that cable is not well shielded, it could be radiating. So we can try disconnecting that while the television is running. Yes, you're not going to get the normal picture on the screen, but with this, wait a minute now, the way modern TV sets work, you can't disconnect that cable. If it's not getting a signal, it won't turn on the display. So doing the divide and conquer is a little bit complicated here. But I think you're telling me that there are better made HDMI cables that are better shielded. Give us a rundown on that one again, John. And are they pricey? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech minute.
KC2WGB, yes, they do make high quality HDMI cables. Glenn would know more than I do. You can see some of them have the little ferrites on them, the little lumpy area on the cable. But what I would suggest is, if it's possible, I don't know the age of the set, turn off the cable box, disconnect it totally from the television set, and just have the television run by itself. If it's that switch mode power supply, it's going to still be there. So that'll narrow it right down. If it's missing, then it's some kind of combination with the ground loops or something coming from the box itself. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
As I see it, Bill, if your tenant will allow you to do these experiments of disconnecting various things while you're listening to the interference on, say, your handy-talkie, if it will show up on a handy-talkie, to hear interference on a handy-talkie is a little bit difficult because you got to be listening to a weak signal at the same time. The way the FM limiter discriminator works in a handy-talkie, if there is nobody on the channel and you simply turn on noise and it doesn't break the squelch, you don't have a real indication. And even if you turn down the squelch to now judge whether or not there's a difference in noise power is a little bit difficult. But do you think your tenant will allow you to do these disconnections of her television set in order to do a divide and conquer? WB2CUK, K2RIW, you got a bill.
I don't think there'd be any problem doing that. We both have the same cable company, so I doubt if it's the box. If I have a box up here and it has a regular coaxial output, I guess it does have an HDMI output for a digital TV, but the one I'm using in my house is regular RF going into these older TVs. I have older television sets. I was offered to give her a 21-inch JVC I've had for 20 years to replace the RCA, but she didn't like that idea. But I think I'd be able to do some of these experiments, be able to get up there in a little meter or something, and I wouldn't know if it went away. But all these things sound definitely worth trying.
Yeah, be careful now, Bill. Even though the box itself might be clean, you and she have the exact same converter box from the cable TV company into your TV set. And the box might be clean. The HDMI cable itself could be the antenna. In other words, the television set with its switch mode power supply making all kinds of zillions of harmonics uses every piece of wire connected to it as an antenna. The 110-volt input cord and maybe the HDMI cable is radiating the signal created by the TV, even though the converter box itself is clean. So tracing this down, it's going to be a little bit difficult, but I think you can handle it. It's going to require a number of experiments, but by divide and conquer, I think you're going to get there. Let's see now. I think we're ready to go over to Freddie. Well, let me check with John first, because I made this mistake a few times. Over to you, John. Are we ready for Freddie? Are we waiting for Clayton? Over to you, John. K2RIW.
KC2QAQ, just one more comment, Dick?
Yeah, Dick, we are ready for Freddie, but I don't know if Freddie's going to be there. He was missing last time. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, these HDMI cables that have got a ferrite chunk built into them so that they stop acting as an antenna. Boy, that sounds awful nice. I hope they're not too pricey. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
What's interesting about the HDMI cables, I really understand why they put the ferrite on there. It's because if you look at the peak-to-peak voltage swings on HDMI and the wave shapes of the digital format for HDMI, it's highly susceptible for immunity problems. In other words, you can actually pick up interference in the signal and you won't get a very good picture. That's why to spend a little bit of extra money in a noisy environment for a better cable will definitely help that. But as far as the type of emission that comes out of HDMI or the RF output is extremely narrow band, and you can almost spot it on one frequency. If I understand Bill correctly, and I think the kind of problem he has, more than likely, I don't suspect that he's going to find this is on a single frequency. He's going to find it's over a broad range of interference. And that's why these power supplies are such a problem. It's because they wipe out whole sections of the band. It's terrible. But I think that the HDMI cable, nice for immunity if you're getting outside interference, but I don't think you're going to find that it's actually radiating. Just an opinion, Dick. KC2QIQ.
I'm going to give you one of the pieces of experience that I had. I remember encountering a 100 KC switching power supply. It was making square waves at 100 KC. And it was very rich in higher harmonics. I could take a single sideband receiver and tune from 3.5 to 4 megs. Every 100 KC, I heard a fuzzy sounding signal. In other words, it was really a comb generator. It was running at a basic square wave frequency of 100 KC, and every 100 KC up the band of multiple ham bands, I could hear a signal. And so if Bill had a scanner, in other words, something that would really be willing to do a beautiful job of this, if you happen to have an ICOM IC R7000, for instance, which has got all kinds of modes of demodulation, and goes from 25 megs to 2 gigs, in the single sideband mode, boy, can that find weak signals, and you tune it across a particular band with some very little, simple little antenna connected to it, just a piece of a coupling connected to the center conductor on the antenna input of that receiver held near that television set. It's going to find these signals, and then by putting that clip lead first near the power cord, near the HDMI cable, near the screen, you're going to find out pretty fast where the maximum radiation is coming from. So this is a different kind of fox hunting you're about to be doing, Bill. And please come back in future weeks as you start running these experiments and let us know what you find. John, are we now ready for Freddy? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Hey, senor. And it's nice to know you bought a new television finally. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the process by which I did it has made my family unhappy. I saw a very good display-looking set of moderate size on sale at a rather nice price. I didn't do any research as to whether or not it's got all the 4K capability downrange and the 120 frames per second or whatever. I didn't get into any of those details. I just wrote a check and said, let's make the problem go away temporarily. And we'll buy the superset at some later time. And so the family is happy that they're seeing a better set. They're unhappy that I didn't do the normal research, if you know what I mean. Let's see if Freddie is there. W2VBN, I think it is. Fred, K2LAW in the TechNet. Well, we'll pass it over to him periodically in between the mailbag items. We're only an hour and a half late for the mailbag. And so we'll take two demerits. KC2WCB, K2RIW. Put a big mark in the big book, John. You got it.
We'll only get a blue star. We won't get a gold star this week. All right. Let me load drop, and I'll go on to my first question with a comment. All right. You know, from Hal's question about talking about antennas, I noticed that in my emails, I get an awful lot of questions concerning the antennas and the feed lines, coupling, and of course, the first question I have today is an antenna. This is a Yagi antenna. The gentleman has existing 400-ohm ladder line. Can he use it? And will it work? And how should he go about hooking it up? For some reason, he doesn't want to run up a piece of coax. He'd like to do it with the 400-ohm ladder line, if possible. So maybe you can give him some directions and where he should start, how he should proceed with that. And this antenna he's using is a 2-meter Yagi that he's hooking up with this ladder line. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
The nice thing about ladder line on its rated frequency is it's very low in insertion loss. 400 ohm ladder line on HF frequencies, beautiful stuff. 400 ohm ladder line on 2 meters, I think is pushing your luck. As the number of wavelengths, fractions of a wavelength, between the two wires of lateral line start approaching a portion of a wavelength. Maybe the number is a tenth of a wavelength, maybe it's a 30th of a wavelength. There's some number, a fraction of a wavelength, of spacing between the two wires where it's no longer a pure transmission line. It starts acting like an antenna. And 450 ohm, I think it's 450 is the magic number for the commercial products. 450 ohm lateral line, I'm not convinced it's rated for service at 2 meters. But let's assume it is. And a little bit of research on that. You go to the manufacturer, they'll tell you what frequency range. They tell you it's got this performance. And if they give you a curve of insertion loss versus frequency, let me drop. Most of these good brands of transmission lines will give you a curve of insertion loss in dBs vertical versus logarithmic frequency horizontal. So this crazy scale for horizontal frequency, which is logarithmic. So it's a sort of a semi-log display. And it's a straight line at roughly a 45-degree angle. And sometimes the end of the line's got a little bit of a hook to it. And if that curve the manufacturer gives you starts off at 1 megacycle and it goes to 50 megacycles and the curve stops there. In other words, the graph itself, the horizontal axis, goes to 100 megs, but the curve that's traced on that XY plot stops at 50 megs. That's a strong indication that they're not telling you what it does beyond that. You might be using it beyond its frequency. But so once you do that research, you find out you do want to keep using it, and it's appropriate for 2 meters. You've now got two or three approaches. The 2 meter Yagi antenna, let me drop it. The 2 meter Yagi antenna probably has a coaxial connector on it. The vast majority of them do. Now you need some kind of a converting device between the 450 ohm line and the 50 ohm coaxial connector that's on the antenna. And is there a commercial product that does that? Probably not very popular, if there is one. Could you build a circuit that does that? Quite easily. A half-wave coax balun, for instance, which would be a very small structure on 2 meters. Half-wave coax balun will keep the conversion between 50 ohms and 200 in one step. And there's ways you can make a variation of that. But to do a step down, which in this case is a step down, but it looks like a step up if you were doing it in the shack end, to make an impedance conversion between 50 ohms and 200 by way of a half-wave coax balun, that's a pretty good way to go. And now, yes, it's 200 ohms and you're looking for 450, and that's a 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio on a particular length of 450 ohm lateral line, maybe it's going to add an extra half a dB. And if the lateral line is giving you 3 dB less loss than any other transmission line you've got in the house, you're coming out way ahead by doing it that way. So a converting device between the impedances, that's one approach. Let me drop.
Come here.
Somebody's got a comment? Who is that? Start up with your call letters, phonetically, and your name, and then give us your comment. Go ahead.
November 2, Romeo Delta Bravo, being Tango NT Mike, and I found the best way to use ladder line on 2 meters for 440. If you're using it as your antenna, there's a whole array of single band and spin staples that you can build. You can actually Google it. Well, that's really the only way I've ever had it successfully work for me, is if I used it as the antenna. The other thing is, you asked for feedback on the TechNet. I would say run it exactly the way you do. Done faithfully for so many years. RDB back to that.
The way I do on the TechNet. That's an extremely vague question, vague statement there, Tim. There's 3,500 hours of TechNet, and we probably have covered 1,000 different subjects. So to do it the way we do on the TechNet, what does the word it mean in that case? Over to you, Tim.
You would ask for feedback as to any changes you could make. I would say stay the course. Been doing a wonderful job for so many years. Keep it up.
Now I see what you're saying. you're giving us a comment on the too much antenna question, so to speak, that was stated earlier. Now I see what you're saying. Okay.
The man sent a check, Dick?
Yeah, we're going to send him a check. Each one of the people who say those words, Tim, we mail them a check. So there's a check in the mail to you. John signs those checks. It's drawn at his bank. Now, to make the ladder line into the antenna itself, if he's building a dipole, you're absolutely right, Tim. He's got an already existing 2-meter Yagi, and he wants to hook this ladder line to that Yagi. It already has a driven element, which already has a 50-ohm connector, I am guessing. So for him to make a converting device between the ladder line and the 50-ohm connector is one approach. He could yank out the dipole of the Yagi that's there, and now make a